KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the thing called Plug and Play on Wednesday, November 28th at 9 p.m. Place called the Jack London Review in downtown Portland. Plug and Play features Dubtonic Crew, Aaron Nigel Smith, and Trinity Sounds, all playing the best in Jamaican reggae and dub music. This is a 21 and over event. Again, that's Plug and Play, featuring Dubtonic Crew, Aaron Nigel Smith, and Trinity Sounds on Wednesday, November 28th at 9 p.m. Place called the Jack London Review, 529 Southwest 4th Avenue in downtown Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hi, I'm J.J. Johnson, host of the Gospel and More program, Sundays from 6 to 8 a.m. We are collecting yarn to make wool caps for the homeless community. Drop off yarn and caps at KBOO 20 Southeast 8th, Monday through Fridays, 9 to 5. We are also looking for knitters. For more information, contact KBOO Gospel and More at gmail.com or go to kboo.fm/gospel and more. The yarn and cap drive will end January the 31st.
Good morning and happy Thanksgiving, KBOO listeners. This is KBOO Portland, and coming up next is First Voices Radio. It's going to be featuring portions of a panel discussion from The Waters That Connect Us, a gathering with those that work in water protection and restoration. And so that is up next. And then at 9, it's Press Watch with Teresa Mitchell.
We choose the right to be who we are. We know the difference between the reality of freedom and the illusion of freedom. There's a way to live with Earth and a way not to live with Earth. We choose the way of Earth. It's about power.
Chasha. Akan tu chasha. Oe to na ke chama khake la kan ombi. O hu to pa na hu pa hu yu khambi. Ta ko us kan skan ombi ke la na yu ha. Ma khake la. Akan khan ta ta ko e chake la ke he ombi.
In addition to relativity, this is First Voices Radio, and I send you greetings and strength from the east gate of Turtle Island, where the sun and the water touch the earth at once. And our website is First Voices Indigenous Radio, and I want to thank you for your generosity. And I'm your host, Teokas and Ghost Tours.
On November 14th, there was a panel called The Waters Connect Us, gathering with those who work in water protection and restoration at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, which featured conversations about sacred water with indigenous environmental water protectors, scientists, and media creators. Those speakers who you will hear on today's First Voices Radio are edited for time segments of the 2.5 hours are myself as a moderator, Teokas and Ghost Horse. Then you will hear a welcome by Billy Frank Jr., a council member of the local Nisqually Nation. Then Louise Benali from the Dene, who is a 58-year-old grandmother, mother, and clan mother from Black Mesa community of Big Mountain in northern Arizona. She is a farmer, permaculturalist, herbalist, traditional counselor, and advisor on different environmental foods. Then Clarice Alita Wesley is a traditional Clackamas Chinook, Wishram, Klickitat, Kalpuya tribal member and grandmother of five, an American Indian Movement member since 1980, and a co-founder of Wanapum Fishing People Against Nestle's in 2015. She is working with indigenous and environmental communities to stop a Nestle water bottling plant on the Columbia River. Then you will hear Jessica Plum, who is an award-winning filmmaker and writer. She is a producer, co-director, and writer of Return of the River, a featured documentary about the largest dam removal in history. recognized with a dozen festival awards, including Best Storytelling by the International Wildlife Film Festival, and reviewed as a hell-raising documentary filmmaking at its best. And now, the Waters Connect Us Conference panel in Olympia, Washington.
The context that I'd like to set was more or less that we are having a conversation with water already. We are working with water. We are in the thought of water and prayer and memory and all those things that science now has coming to find out that what the native peoples are saying is really true. Today, it opens up a little bit in not so much the mental, but the energy exchange that we want to express in that consciousness of who we are as indigenous folks here. So with that, I'd like to ask Willie Frank to welcome us here, because this is near the Nisqually area lands, and we'll begin after this.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Willie Frank III. My Indian name is Kualashkid. That was given to me by my grandfather. And I want to welcome you guys all to this event today. It's truly an honor for me to be up here. And we're on the homelands of the Medicine Creek Territory, Squaxin, and Nisqually and Puyallup. So I want to welcome you guys, and I hope we can get some good communication out of this and move forward all together. Thank you.
So Suri and I were talking yesterday, and we wondered what could we start with here. In our experiencing life as young people, as older people here now, is there was some moment, a seminal moment in our lives that switched something, switched our hearts to switch our brains, which was already in our hearts, that here's the work we must do, because I hear a lot of prophecies about Native people talking about this time, these times. This conversation will begin with our experience and what we feel out of our experience. Each one of our panelists here, if you would volunteer yourself to what it meant, water meant to you at that time in your young life that changed your mind to even be here today.
And now Louise Benali from the Dene, a clan mother from Black Mesa, Arizona, of Big Mountain in northern Arizona.
I'll go next. I'm Louise Benali. I'm from the Southwest, and their water is very scarce. So in my sense of realizing things, you know, my grandfathers, my mothers, my father, they all were ceremonial people that did many kinds of healing practices, and every one of it involved water. And so I was taught at a young age that water is life, that it hears, that it sees, that it knows, and that it is the key element for survival. So I brought the crystal. This is water. So we see things through this. If we're not find answers at the human level, then we go to this. And this goes to the stars, to the, you know, planets of and the universe. So we bring messages through it, and it is from water. And this is the first life, as I was taught, was these were the living beings before what you see as living things now. So now they live in under the surface and some on surface. And they communicate with light, and that's what I was taught. And also that, you know, the abalone, I was told, is fire and water, and that is an element of the earth that is mixed of two different things, and that's what it represents. And then in my way, my people's way, the corn pollen is our key offering element for life, because without pollen there is no life, there is no food, and all that is impacted now because of greed. And in the country where I come from, we're in a high desert, terrain, and there's not much surface water. We don't have rivers. We don't have abundance of water, lakes, you know, like you have here in the Northwest. And so there, all that is drying out and everything is changing. And the rain now is monitored and manipulated by, you know, human beings. They spray, they make clouds, and it rains or it snows, you know. And it's the so-called U.S. military, the U.S. NASA, you know, the space people. They mess with everything, and they are messing with things that shouldn't be messed with. So now you see the consequences of that, of it returning nature, you know, lifting its hands, and you got the forest fires, you got the drying out of waters, the diminishing of the natural resources such as fishes, different lives in the ocean, different lives on the surface. The elements of the earth is changing, as in food, you know, from the changes in the atmosphere. So it all regulates one another, and the moon is the regulator of the water, and even that they messed with by trying to set off a bomb up there a few years back. And so, you know, we're creating this mess in the name of greed first, secondly, in the name of education. You know, what more do you need to know? Isn't just your life enough? You know, that's my question. And so we are impacted, we are feeling it, and we are disturbed by it. So there's so much hostility in the outer world out there. You know, people are turning to the pharmaceutical world to hopefully address some of these things, but then it has a lot of side effects. So the same thing with the experiments that are going on with the atmosphere, with the earth itself, and with the sounds in the ocean, you know, it's disrupting the lives in the ocean. So water should not be disturbed, water should be respected. But yet, you know, we have people that walk this earth that don't have any conscience, and they want to mess with everything, everything. And there are some things that we're not supposed to mess with. We're messing with those things. So we're bringing it on ourselves that way as human species. And so for myself, I don't have a formal education. I come from where there is no water. I still live in a home with dirt floor. I still have to go out and pick wood to make warmth to cook with. I still have to haul water. But the water in my region are all contaminated by uranium mining, by coal mining, by oil and gas development, and it's impacting my nation and all the living things, including the air, the water itself. And so, you know, that's where I come from, and I have to find ways to continue to spread the message, share the message, and hopefully looking for, you know, remedies that might help change the contaminants in the soil and the water that will also impact the air. So that's my journey in this life, and it's always been, and because of greed, my community has been disturbed for so long because our so-called tribal government sign off lands to outside companies that want to develop. And then they come in and desecrate the land, toxify it, and then move on to the next space. So this is a pattern that needs to change also, and that's in your hands as young people, if you can find ways to educate the people, to help them wean off this need to have mineral extraction, to make energy. There's other ways to make energy, but they don't want to see that because it doesn't fill up their pockets. And so it's in your hands as young people to help find that way so that we can have a future. Thank you.
And now Clarice Alita Wesley, a co-founder of Wanapum Fishing People Against Nestle.
Good morning, my dear people. My name is Clarice Wesley. I'm from the Columbia River. I live in Cascade Locks. I co-founded the Wanapum Fishing People Against Nestle when they came into our town in 2008 to take Oxbow Springs. In our language, that's Kopwanaich, just the name of that spring. It's really pretty. It's not a pipe coming out of a rock. It's the spring, the pool. The city wanted to sell this water to Nestle. They would extract 230 million gallons a year from our sacred spring there. That area is on Warm Spring ceded land. But the tribes didn't even find out about this till 2015 and wrote letters. I had a display, but I didn't, I apologize, didn't bring it. I had it last night at the dinner. The groups Food and Water Watch and Local Water Alliance and BARC, they had been fighting this, you know, since 2008. We didn't find out. The fishermen's, none of the fishermen's knew on the river and their loose sites, what's called fishing loose sites. My son had to go all up and down along Washington, along the Columbia River, and Oregon sighted all the loose sites, asking the fishermen, have you heard of this? Have you heard of this? He was after me for like 2 years because he found out about this, what they were trying to do to our spring. And like when brother down here talked about, you know, the springs that regulates the water temperature and the water level so that it's just right for the fish. And those things are covered in our treaty, the Treaty of 1855 with the Columbia River Tribes. And it even says in there, it necessitates, you know, water to be there in order for us to practice our fishing rights, our livelihood. You know, from our beginning of time, we would harvest the fish. And it's a part of our spiritual practice. We drink the chush, the water, before we eat. There's a song for that. And then when we're done, we drink the water, because I'm not telling you anything you don't know here. You know, nothing can survive without water. When I was young, I've never told this story. I think maybe I was ashamed. I remember as a little girl, they said, there's going to come a time when they'll be able to control the weather. You know, this industrial world. Gee, I remember thinking to myself as a little girl, if that happens, I'm going to kill myself, I said to myself. And that's the first time I've shared this. But you know, as Native people, this is our land. Our ancestors are from here. That's how we're connected to our land. And so we feel when our earth is suffering. We might not have the big scientific fancy words until we get educated or meet other people that know these words to explain it, but we feel it, the suffering of our earth, because when all the animals suffer, then we suffer when the land suffers, because what we do to the earth, we do to ourselves. When I was young, you know, young woman, teenager, and I really feel for you young people, and ashamed of my generation, even all of us, what have we left you? What have we done? What have we not done so that you're going to have a earth that's livable? You're going to have air you can breathe, clean water somewhere. Now, Nestle wants to own our water rights. So we kicked them out of Oregon. we won that battle. Yeah, right. So you can win. You can win. It took about 10 years, but here's the thing. You have to get it before the papers are signed and sealed and delivered. You have to start fighting it before that, because once they have the permits through the Water Resource Department and the Fish and Wildlife and all that, once that goes through, it's done. So I know a lot of you young people are no different than us, maybe, you know, when we was all young, those of us that are activists. It's confusing. What issue do I pick? Do I save the whales, the salmon, the trees, the spotted owl, the water, the little children that are suffering, special needs? And me, I'm an educator. I worked with Native education, you know, most of my life. It's my life's work. I love children. And I would think to myself, what's the best thing now? Do we work with our children so we can shape their minds, you know, so they can love the earth and be responsible in their everyday actions? Or do we go over here and get in the front lines and chain ourselves up, you know, to the trees or whatever, the trains that bring the oil and coal, all of that? You know, sometimes I know it's confusing. We get overwhelmed and we want to do it all. So I could just advise to, you know, try to pick one thing, because it's, you know, it is all connected. Try to pick one thing, and you try to do too much, you'll get overwhelmed and depressed maybe and just fall down somewhere. So try to find that one thing. And then, you know, for me, as I got to be an adult like that, and I was thinking that, well, I remember when, you know, when I first moved to Portland from the reservation from Warm Springs, and I heard that in the news, they said, there's been a drought here for 50 years. And I thought, gee, every time I come to Portland, it's raining, you know, it's always raining. How can there be a drought, you know? But there is, and it's absurd, you know, for the city of Cascade Locks to decide that we're going to just give Nestle our water rights. They are after our water rights. They started with what was called a water exchange application, and then they went to water rights to take our water rights away. And because of our tribes that got involved, the four tribes, Warm Springs, Yakima, Umatilla, and Nez Perce, we were able to stop that. They will no longer be able to use that, not even in the future. They can't use the transfer of water rights application anymore. So that was a huge success. But I was thinking about what's the more important issue, and with all the in the politics, all the issues out there with immigration and women's rights to choose and all of these things, so many issues. None of those are going to mean anything without water. None of those are going to mean anything without our earth. If it's not livable, none of those will mean anything. So maybe sometimes I think we should just all be trying to work on the water issues. But when we first found out about Nestle in 2015, I was thinking, like, we got our four tribes, you know. They're far away. How can we get this information to everybody right now? We had to do it now. Time was getting short. And so I decided to do a fast with no food and water for 5 days. And I sat in front of the city hall in Cascade Locks. We called it the Anime Leonard Fast, in honor of Anime Aquash and Leonard Peltier with the American Indian Movement. Anime Leonard represented all four tribes during that fast. And when the people of Hood River County in 2016, brought forth a ballot measure to protect the water in Hood River County, and we're successful. We won that too. But the governor of Oregon, Kate Brown, and all the agencies, Fish and Wildlife, for Water Resource Department, decided, no, we're going to go ahead with this anyway. And this is supposed to be the green state, you know, Oregon, Washington. But no, we're going to go ahead with this. And so, but they didn't. So, you know, you can win. You can win. It takes a lot. You have to organize. And when I did that first fast, by the end of the day, it was on the Facebook all over, and all kinds of tribal members showed up from the reservation. It was surprised, you know, that fast, everybody showed up. And one of the things that was really unique about this, you know, back in the day in the 80s during the fish wars and all of the other, you know, wars we have with the powers that be, normally as Native activists, you know, we're up against the city, you know, the townspeople, the county, the state, all of the agencies, the state agencies, and our own tribes. At this time, we were all together in it, except for the state and the agencies, but, you know, oh, and the city council, but otherwise the people, all our councils were against Nestle, and they came to the rallies and spoke, represented. So things are getting better. Things are getting better, so don't give up. That's like a message I want to give to you today, to know that you can do this and that you can win. And that we have to, because we don't really have a choice. Before I forget, I wanted to let you guys know, I don't know if you know that Nestle is after your water here in Washington. Did you know that? Does anybody here know that? Okay, yeah, so those of you that are, you know, wanting to do something, you better start now. And we don't know exactly which spring, but we can assume they're going to go after all of them, whichever ones they can get along the Columbia River. So I would suggest contacting the governor and all the state agencies and making sure that they know that you don't want Nestle in your state. And I would even contact this. Maybe somebody here knows the water scientist that can figure out, you know, we don't even want people to know where the springs are on our Columbia River. The elders said, don't show them, you know, these things, because, you know, then next thing they're going to be gone. So, but if you hear, you know, of them approaching a city council somewhere in one of the towns, they always go after a small town, it seems like, then, you know, you might even spend some time just calling those, pick five towns, you know, each of you pick five towns and call them and ask them, you know, is Nestle approaching you? You would have to probably start right now, because their name is not Nestle Waters Northwest for anything. That's their regional name. We stopped them from Cascade Locks and over here to Washington at Walla Walla, Waitsburg, and then in Goldendale. The Yakima tribal members just filled up the council hall there, and they didn't even get any farther. So I just wanted to say that, let you know, make sure you are prepared. Thank you.
And now Jessica Plum, filmmaker and writer.
Well, greetings, and it's a tremendous honor to be among this group of people on this panel, and I really want to thank you specifically for giving voice to the suffering of the earth, and also to the confusion that many of us feel when we are younger about where to take our energy, our activism, sometimes our anger, sometimes our love, on all of these issues. And I am also here to share the message that you can win. As a filmmaker, here on the Olympic, or on the Olympic Peninsula where I live, I've had the real pleasure over 8 years now of bearing witness to an extraordinary success story. And I imagine that many of you are familiar with it. How many of you are familiar with the story of the Elwha River on the Olympic Peninsula? Some of our visitors from afar, it is still the site of the largest dam removal on the planet, although I think will be overtaken by others, hopefully soon. two major dams were removed between 2011 and 2014. And I had the honor, I felt, as a media maker, as a filmmaker, to bear witness to that journey and also to act as a voice and an advocate for the river. However, I, as long and as challenging as it is to make a feature film, and all of you who are here in media studies, I'm sure you're well aware of that, it pales in comparison to the effort and energy it takes to restore and advocate for a river. And for that, I want to say my most heartfelt thank you to the many Indigenous communities who were involved, but most particularly the community on the Lower Elwha, of the Lower Elwha, who are among the Salish Coast Nations here around the Salish Sea, who took an unwavering stand for the Elwha River for a century. Those dams went up. The first dam went up exactly 100 years before it came down, and they were illegal the whole time. They were both built without fish passage, and a law did exist on the books here in Washington State that required that fish passage be built anywhere where salmon were, in the language of the time, want to ascend. And those dams made it for 100 years until they finally came down, thanks to the many voices that spoke out for them. But I heard the opening of a question of how do each one of us come to the advocacy, to the care, to the love of water? And how did I, as a filmmaker, come to this moment of truly committing myself to a labor of love, which was to work on a feature film for years and years and years, initially with no funding, eventually with, to tell this story? And the truth is, that seed got planted much earlier than even my move to the Olympic Peninsula, which is now close to two decades ago. I grew up on the waters on the coast of Maine, and I mean that literally, largely on a boat. And I, however, had the experience as a young adult to go far away, halfway around the world, and I found myself working in China. And I was on the Yangtze River during the time that the largest dam ever built on planet Earth was under construction. It hadn't been completed yet. At the time, I wasn't filmmaking. I was largely a teacher and a writer. And I had the opportunity in those capacities to take one of the last ferries down the Yangtze River before the dam was complete. And this ferry stopped at one little community after another that were all slated to be inundated literally within a matter of months. It's a journey I will never forget as long as I live. And at each one of those stops, what struck me initially is that there were big red lines painted in red paint. Some of those lines were on temples, places of worship. Some of them were on schools or homes or just on the rocks on the hillside. And you can guess what those red lines meant. They were the line of the future inundation level that was going to occur with the completion of the Yangtze River Dam. So each one of those villages that I saw on that trip no longer exists. They're all gone. And I haven't been back specifically to the Yangtze since the dam was completed and each one of those villages went underwater. But what struck me at that moment is that even with just months or maybe weeks for some of them to go, there was all this life going on close to the water, where life always happens, close to a river, right? Every river has its people, as we all know. And markets were open and the streets were bustling as if the water was never going to rise. And it did. And now when I look around as a coastal resident, I see in my own mind those red lines everywhere, and life bustling away on all of our coastal waterfronts as if the water is never going to rise, some 20 years later here. And so that journey on the Yangtze has haunted me both from the perspective of all of us who will inevitably contend with sea level rise, but also more specifically around the impact that a dam has on a river. So fast forward to 2011 on the Olympic Peninsula, where I'm raising my daughter and making a life with gratitude for the abundance of this land that that we share and have the opportunity to live on as well. And the deconstruction of the Lower Elwha Dam began. I went there first not to start a film, but with my daughter, who was then in kindergarten. And I found myself on an overlook, very similar in a way to the overlook I'd stood on many years ago, watching a dam being built. And at that overlook long ago in the Yangtze, because of the nature of the government at the time, people didn't speak about what they saw happening, but I was reading a story in the faces and a story of worry and loss. Standing at this overlook on the Elwha River, I was seeing a story of absolute giddy anticipation as bulldozers were lining up about to take down a dam after the many hard, hard years of advocacy had won a success on paper. And so I returned on a camera, with a camera and others, and also began to have a collaboration for which I am very grateful with Frances Charles, the chairwoman of the Lower Elwha Kalam tribe, and began to document the process of the removal of those dams. And as a storyteller and a filmmaker, every now and then, maybe even once in a lifetime, a story grabs you by the scruff of the neck like a little kitten, and it just won't let you go. And watching the dust rise from the jackhammers on that dam, I knew that I was going to complete a film about that story, no matter what it took. And it took a lot, just as it took a lot to undam those rivers. But I'm so grateful to also be able to share the message that you can win, and that the Elwha River is an example of that, and that the care and intention that I found bringing to that river goes far, far back to my own roots and experiences in other places, but that ever since I have made my media-making life around water issues and water protection here in the Pacific Northwest, the land that I've grown to love. And it's truly a deep pleasure to be around activists such as the ones I've worked with and to hear your stories. Thank you.
Once again, Billy Frank Jr., a Nisqually Tribal Council member.
Good morning, I guess, everyone. I hope everyone's doing good today. Hope everyone's awake on this nice rainy day. As I said, my name's Willie Frank III. I'm a Nisqually Tribal Council member, but more important, I'm a fisherman on the Nisqually River. The Nisqually tribe, we manage 80 miles from Mount Rainier to the mouth of the Nisqually River. And I don't know if too many people have been on the Nisqually, but it's one of the most beautiful places you'll see in the world, I feel like. And, you know, our mountain is Tukwotma, we call our mountain. And that means don't forget the water. And my grandfather, Willie Frank Sr., he lived to be 104 years old. And he used to talk about paradise. The Nisqually Indians lived in paradise at the mouth of the river all the way up to the mountain. And I always think back because he was born in 1879. So I think about what would it be like in 1879, and here we are in 2018. And you think about what it looked like back then. I honestly believe we all lived in paradise. You know, the water was clean. The air was clean. Our food was clean. Everything we put into our bodies was clean. And you're seeing such a change right now in society. As I said, I'm a fisherman, you know, and I fish along the Nisqually River. My father, Billy Frank Jr., lived to be 83 years old, and he was still fishing with us on the Nisqually at 82 years old. And you'd see that the passion he had for our salmon, for our water, for our environment. And he spent his whole life protecting that and fighting for that, to give myself and everybody in this room a better life. You know, and you're seeing the impacts of climate change. You're seeing the impacts of population growth. You're seeing the impacts of I-5 on our river, on our sound, our beautiful Puget Sound here. And, you know, we spend a lot of time going back and forth with the state of Washington, and even more time with the federal government, because we have an administration right now in Washington, D.C., that doesn't see the environment as being an issue. And it's really sad to see that, because I always tell people I don't want to be that generation where I'm holding a picture of a salmon and telling my kids one day, hey, this is what we used to catch on the Nisqually River. This is what your grandpa used to catch. This is what your great-grandpa used to catch. And that all ties into water, clean water. We need clean water in this life, in this world that we live in. And, you know, I feel like at times we all take water for granted at times. And to hear our elder from Northern Arizona talk about that, you know, it means a lot to hear that. Because, you know, we sit here in the state of Washington and we look outside and we see the beautiful green trees. We see the rain. So we think we have an unlimited amount of water. But I'm here to tell you guys that that's not the truth. Because with the economic and the growth in the state, you know, people come up here not understanding the history about who we are as Washingtonians, but more or less of Native people. You know, we're managers of the resources. We're managers of the land. And the science is good. The science is great. But our tribal members and our elders and our people know when our salmon is healthy, when our water is healthy, and when our air is healthy. And, you know, as I said, fishing on the Nisqually River, we're always in a battle with the state over salmon. And it's really unfortunate because we're fighting over every last salmon right now. And I always tell people that for me, it's not catching every last salmon. As I said, I don't want to be that generation that catches the last fish. But what I tell people, being on that river is for me, it's like going to church. You know, it's like being able to set that net, being able to exercise our treaty rights and our way of life. That's more important to me than this almighty dollar that we have. And I try to educate our younger generation about your culture, about your treaty right, about tribal sovereignty, because that's really the issue that we're dealing with. And as a tribal leader, I try to get folks to understand that it can't be just the tribes fighting for the environment. It has to be all of us working together. And, you know, I tell people that. I tell them that, you know, it's got to be now. We have to start making a difference. What we're doing now is going to affect the next 80 and 100 years out. You heard Ed talk about the seventh generation. You know, I grew up with one of the greatest teachers in the world, Billy Frank Jr. He taught me every day about what it was to walk in this world. And, you know, I tell these politicians and these different folks that you guys are only here for a short period of time. The Nisqually tribe, the Medicine Creek tribes, the tribes throughout the United States, we're going to be here forever. We've been here since the beginning. We're going to be here till the end. But we need to really start coming together and protecting this beautiful Mother Earth and the environment that we have. I'm just happy to be here today, sitting up here with this great panel. So I thank you.
Don't have a story to add to this, but I think what important is out there, because I travel a lot and get a lot of perspective worldwide with indigenous folks all over the world. And one thing that they hold in common is their traditional way, not so much the education of the West. Some of you know that the etymology of educate, what it really means is to draw out or lead away. It really means educe or seduce. The etymology is to draw out or lead away from dot, 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 or ellipsis, but it really means spirit. And to replace with knowledge and information. Now, who is this knowledge and information controlled by? Is it the West? Is it who we are as Native peoples? Is it our knowledge and, as you call it, wisdom? But wisdom is always at the love of spirit. And so if you're not aware of how active Native people have been even before 1492, that we're still, in light of all the things that are happening to the earth, we're still, and the word that I heard almost in a common here was fighting. It's almost like we're at war against a language and a consciousness or even a system that's at war against the earth. So when I think about this, where does that leave us? But are we battle weary that we have to maybe stop all of this and going to that place in the United States Capitol called Washington, almost said Redskins, Washington, D.C., where I do know because of the history of studying here at its Evergreen College that there is a Lenni Lenape burial ground right underneath the U.S. Capitol Dome. So when we understand these things from the deep level of the earth where we come from, as Native people, traditionally, we've been uploading the DNA of the earth consistently rather than some downloading sky god type of thing. But the combination of that, now it's here. So when I talk to people like Louise, and we talk about the feeling that we exchange here in the consciousness. And what I wanted to ask is, you know, the actions that we often are doing. I think about what if we didn't have telephones? What if we didn't have the cars? What if we didn't are able to do Facebook and all that other technological stuff that we think that we'll always be here? Because I always think about the scenario that someone's going to shut it off. Then what are we doing? Do we really care enough? Because we are changing the world because of technology, but isn't technology changing us about how we see the world? So when you go back to the spiritual fire that we all understand here, Willie talked about it. We all talked about what we do here in our, but you have to take this consciousness, this awareness out there too. Because when you go around the world, the other peoples know about the Native peoples here. And I could think that they really don't care less about America, except that it's a dream that hasn't really come true yet. It's because of the lack of recognition of the knowledge and information that Native people still retain, regardless. So I think the next question that I'm leading to is, what makes us tick? What makes us still go on as old as we are? We're still doing this. And are we really successful yet? Is it an ongoing fight all the time? Why are we using fighting language when it's really about peace with Earth? So the peace with Earth is what this language is talking about. When we speak our languages, we're talking about the peace with Earth. And I will introduce that in a way that I was told by an elder, Virgil Kilstraight, from Pine Ridge, and he's Hunkpapa in Oglala. He basically, I was sitting in the middle of Auschwitz and Birkenau in 2013, and we had a little ceremony, and we came out, and the first thing I asked him, I said, Uncle Lakshi, do we have a word in Lakota for domination? And he quickly said, there's no word, there's no concept. We can't even allow that thought into a relational language, you see. So it's not built on dominating and putting fences up and dividing and how much something's going to cost and measuring. It's built on the relationship with water, with the land, with the plants and animals, these nations, other nations first. Because if we don't recognize the tree nation that's strong here, the water nation, the fish nation, the bird nation, then what are we recognizing but our own anthropocentric way of viewing life, that it's only about us humans? You see, that we have to save the earth rather than allowing the earth, which she's already doing, to save us, you see. And I think that's what is a mainstay among, I feel it among the panel here. And if you all want to, you know, join in with this thought process, that would, you know, convey it to you this way as elders or people who are doing rather than becoming. And I could preface this with this, is that there's, in this language, there's no to be. That's a verb, but it's no to be in our language. To be what? When you already are, you see. So with that groundwork and conversation, if you could add to that, that would be awesome.
Billy Frank Jr.
You know, I was thinking back to when you were talking about fighting. You know, that's what I was always taught. You know, my family and many of our local people, you know, they went through the fishing wars here in the 60s and 70s, so they were fighters, you know. And we're in a different time now. It's not time to fight anymore. We don't need to be so defensive and fight, you know. And I feel like the Washington tribes are always trying to sit at the table with the state and the federal government, you know, but at times we do need to we do need to fight, whether it's in court or whether it's in the meeting rooms, you know. And the tribes here in the state are 9-0 against the Supreme Court, you know. And you have unfortunately, we have to continue to educate people. And we have an attorney general right now who decides he wants to fight tribal treaty rights and sovereignty. And it's unfortunate, because these are supposed to be the allies we're working with to make everybody's life better. And I you're right. I don't like using that word fight, because we're all human beings. We're all here. We're all Washingtonians. We all come from different cultures, backgrounds, religions. But at the end of the day, we need to all be here protecting the environment and protecting what Mother Earth and the Creator gave us.
Once again, Luis Benali.
Well, the battle continues. To me, treaty does not mean anything. It has not done anything except take our rights away and to be kept in a prison known as reservations. And there we have no rights whatsoever. Everything that is thrown at us through the so-called court system has never worked for my community. You know, we challenged many cases and it's always against us, because it's an instrument of the empire. The imperial world wants to dominate and control and consume and colonize. So then you're there catering, being told what to do and how to do it. And for me, the battle is every day. And my supreme law of the land is not a man-made law. My supreme law of the land is the earth itself, the water, the fire, and the air. That's what I was taught. That's all I can give power to. And we still hold our weapon. As long as we hold our weapon, we're who we are, regardless of who's trying to dominate us. As long as we don't accept that, don't allow that, it will, you know, we either acknowledge it or we just draw a line and say no. And I did that already. So for me, that's a battle that's ongoing. You know, like I said, we've gone through the court systems. We've gone through the legislative procedures. They want that land for its resources, and nothing, there's no justice in it. So we continue. We mobilize. We've been, you know, fighting this battle since 50 years ago and even beyond. And so as long as we have our songs, our prayers, our ways, which are not regulated by the so-called system, we're fine, as long as we don't allow that to dominate us. And so that's, you know, where we stand. And many times we're alone, only with our natural world, with the whole world against us. But do we bow down and, you know, hang in there and say, please, you know? No, we don't. We ignore. We ignore that. I ignore that. I don't give it any power, because I was told the sun is your father, the earth is your mother, the mountains are your rulers, the waters are your rulers. That's the only law that you're going to live by as a woman, and you're going to pass that to the next generation, to the next generation. So I travel, I get told, come over here, help us, you know. So I spread the message and continue to do so. And so, you know, we're in a crucial time. And our stories, these so-called fossil fuels, were in the past they were living beings, and some of them were things that we didn't want to face as humans. They were put away, but if we should come dig it out and make it live again, it's going to come and destroy us, because they were set in those places where they are now for a reason. And so to dig them out and make power with it, and you know, it's comfortable and all, but there's an ending result, and that's what we're dealing with now. And so that's how I see it. I know I have no place in this so-called Western system. I'm not recognized. My community's not recognized. We don't have a tribal council that represents us or speaks for us, because they're token Indians that are already sold out. They're given money so that they could give our way of life up to the energy companies that are destroying our Mother Earth. And we have to speak out and say no. And that's where we are in my community. And a lot of times people are confused, you know. And so we try to educate our young ones, but most times, you know, they want to be the empire. They want to be that is totally opposed to us. And, you know, but when they can't go make that next step, who do they go back to? They go home. They want a prayer. They want a ceremony. And that's when they get told, you know, this is why you were told at one time, this is who you are, what you are, and you can only be this one. You can't be that one, because it's not going to happen. So I see that in many places, you know. I've been to the United Nations. I've been through the U.S. court system. I've been in jail many times. And yet, you know, my love is for the land, for the trees, for our natural springs, for the water, and for our future generation and our survival, because that's the only thing that we really are. These other things are made up, and they can be changed anytime. So they're not real in that sense. So, you know, thank you.
I would like to thank those who gathered for the Waters Connect Us panel held at the Evergreen State College campus on November 14th. And those guests who we heard today were Billy Frank Jr., Louise Benally, Clarice Wesley, Jessica Plum, and we are grateful to those who we didn't get to hear due to time constraints, Rosebud Whiteplume, Carrie Leroy, and Ed Johnstone. I want to especially give thanks to Suri Talfinia, who, among others, organized the Waters Connect Us, and to the volunteers, the programs, and funders at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, who helped make this event possible. Those are the Evergreen State College Foundation, MediaWorks, Longhouse Education and Cultural Center, KAOS Radio, Electronic Media, A People's Geography of American Empire, Environmental Analysis, Native American Studies, Studio Arts, Environmental Health, Public Health and Toxicology, and to everyone who shared ideas and volunteered their time in support of the event, Water Restoration and Protection. Thank you for joining us here today on First Voices Radio. My name is Teokasin Ghost Horse.
Listening to KBOO Portland. Press Watch is up next.
to be part of the 2018 Willamette Week Give Guide. This year, Willamette Week and KBOO are challenging our community to give with their dollars and take action by showing up in real life. KBOO has been showing up for over 50 years. Give to KBOO today and you get full access to the Chinook Book app, plus freebies from Laughing Planet, Gluten Free Gem, Wee Press, and Nosa Familia Coffee. You can contribute right now at kboo.fm/give or call 503-231-8032. Support KBOO, where music makes the movement.
Watch a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell, and though it may be press watch, it's also Genocide Cover-Up Day, the return from the mass grave. Yep, the worm has turned, and here I am back doing a Genocide Cover-Up Day. So I hope that you will stay tuned to your community radio station, KBOO Portland, because I've got some readings to share with you from People's History of the United States, a tradition now, and an Indigenous People's History of the United States by Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. We'll be getting to that in a minute. Right now, I want to pass along some headlines from Radio Havana, Cuba. The Donald Trump administration is reportedly beginning to draw down the nearly 6,000 troops stationed at the U.S.-Mexico border with active duty